So the purpose of this introductory talk now, we're still not going to go to the text except quotes from it, is to look at half a dozen of the key themes that keep emerging in the book of Ecclesiastes. Next week we'll start from verse 1 and work through in 2 weeks. So vanity is one of the key words. We hear this word, that's our translation of it, of course, 27 times throughout the brief number of chapters. The Hebrew word that translated is the word hebel, from which, by the way, we get the name Abel in the story of Cain and Abel. Cain means smith. So he's the symbol of the city. And it's what Abel is the symbol. They're not human beings, of course, the stories. Abel is the country people, and they're fighting over wells and the difficulty of the settled people and the nomads and all that stuff, which history is full of. But he's called Abel because Hebel, he's there, he's gone. The image is of a wisp of smoke. It's there 1 minute, it's gone the next. It's no accident this is the name given to Abel. His sacrifice is accepted by God. He seems a better man than his brother Cain, but he quickly disappears from the story and leaves no trace. The author of Ecclesiastes, however, is not just commenting on the passing nature of things. He's challenging us to face up to the reality of the human condition, in which there's no consistency between the expectations we have in regard to our actions, or I should say they had, maybe we have too, and the actual outcomes that we experience. If we work from the premise that God is just, we can't make any sense of what we're actually experiencing. It violates logic. It's absurd. Vanity of vanities. One consequence of this is that it's foolish to find meaning in our lives from power. Plenty of people try to do that. Wealth, success, everything, here's a key expression in this book, everything under the sun. Now the only thing, not the only reality, not under the sun, is God. So under the sun, everything other than the transcendent and necessarily incomprehensible God, our poor little two-watt brains can't theologize about God and lock God in. It's fleeting, it's unpredictable, it's unreliable, like a puff of smoke. Apart from God, everything we experience is in and of itself insubstantial, deceptive, a pretense, an illusion. This is true of piety, even of the righteousness, and of much that goes under the name of, inverted commas, wisdom. All, says our author, is hebel. Everything has its place if we see it as a gift of God, and you'll be good on that, beautiful on that. If, however, we look to anything other than God to find meaning in our lives, we lack wisdom. Ecclesiastes doesn't just make the claim. It challenges you and me to look at our experience honestly and without evasion, to see for ourselves that this is the way things are. Okay, 27 times when we look at the text that will emerge, and we'll see it when it comes, but that's a general idea as an introduction. What about power? Solomon was a symbol of power. And in the chapter 8 of our book, he does whatever he pleases. For the word of the king is powerful. Who can say to him, what are you doing? They've got complete, absolute power. A bit like the Pope, I suppose you'd say. I don't know if there are any absolute powers in the world apart from the popes. But if there are, you can think of it. But that would be the way it is, I think. There's no questioning and there's no comeback and there's no qualifications. So no one can say, what do you do? I don't mean that as an anti-papal, anti-pope statement, but I think theologically that's the way it's structured. Yet our author has to admit, chapter 2, verse 18, I hated all my toil in which I had toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to those who come after me. And who knows whether they'll be wise or foolish? You've worked all your working life to build up something, and you leave it to this no hope of son of yours. I don't know you personally, so I don't want to reply. But you might wonder, so give it to the church before you die. What an interesting thought. I was paid to suggest that. Yet, they will be master of all, says the Ecclesiastes, they'll be master of all I've toiled for and used my wisdom under the sun, and that's vanity. That's pretty stupid, says the author. Power is fragile. In his world, lose the land and you lose your power. An invasion happens, you've lost everything, gone. The Titanic sinks. What would Solomon say if he could see the depressed state of his kingdom reduced to a tiny province in the Trans-Euphrates satrapy of Persia, part of a system that's inherently corrupt? And he built up this empire that he left to his posterity. Did he? Here's chapter 5, verse 8. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor, and our author saw plenty of it, and the violation of justice and right, don't be amazed at the matter, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over him. Talk to the parish priest, he'll talk to the bishop will talk to somebody else, and it'll end up at the... I'm sounding a bit anti-papal, but I don't really... But, I mean, that's what happens. So what can you do to change this, you might ask? With power comes fame, but fame, says our author in chapter 7, like perfume, quickly evaporates. One might say, thanks be to God, but anyway. Wealth. Is wealth something that gives meaning to life? All we have to do is look at Solomon to see, quote, Ecclesiastes 10, money makes all things possible. The trouble is that if we're driven by the desire for wealth, says our author, and you check this whether it's true or not, we're never satisfied. He says in chapter 5, the lover of money will not be satisfied with money, nor the lover of wealth with gain. This also is hebel. He's not against having things. He's just saying, don't make that just ambition. If we're unwise enough to think we can find meaning in wealth, we haven't the wisdom to see our way to break the cycle and free ourselves from our obsession. We're wealthy, so we spend. We consume, so we have to keep acquiring to feed our need. Riches can, he quote chapter 5, lost in a bad venture. Give your money to the church, it's lost. Furthermore, as he says in chapter 5, as they came from their mother's womb, so shall they go again, naked as they came. They'll take nothing for their toil, which they may carry away with their hands. Eventually, you lose it all anyhow. So there must be something more to life than that. Chapter 2, he says, I turned, I gave my heart up to despair concerning all the toils of my labour under the sun. Because sometimes one who's toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill may leave all to be enjoyed by another who didn't toil for it. This also is vanity, and it's a great...
The thing about accumulating things is you have to look after them. Or some people do.
That's true.
But it takes up your time.
So we might recall in this context Jesus' warning. What will it profit you? This is Ignatius said this to Francis Xavier. at the University of Paris, and he got to him eventually. He said to Francis Xavier, Jesus' words, what will it profit you if you gain the whole world but forfeit your life? Another theme for us to contemplate, work. Ecclesiastes, the book, demands that we work. Our ability to do work is a gift of God. Chapter 3, verse 10. I've seen the business that God has given to everyone to be busy with. So God's given us something to do, work. Our work, he says, gives pleasure to God. So Kohelet insists, all your hands find to do with the strength you have, will do it. So he's in favour of getting on and getting it done. Do it. Yet, work does not in and of itself give meaning to our lives. You may or may not agree with this. I'm only telling you what Ecclesiastes says. How passing were the great building achievements of Solomon? If we want our lives to have meaning, we've got to look elsewhere. Happiness, another theme that comes back and back all the way through the book. Again and again, Kohelet tells us to accept whatever joy God gives us. You'll love this part of it. It's so good. And make the best of God's gifts. All we have is the present moment. The past is gone. The future doesn't exist. It's good to seek what's better as long as we recognise that this too is unreliable. As we've already noted, she, that's the Kohelet, warns people against the insatiable desire for more, a desire that gets in the road of enjoying the present moment. So rather than enjoy this moment, we're thinking, what am I projecting into the future? And the moment's here. I have to tell you, speaking now as a priest of weddings, not every wedding, thank God, people take photos and spoil the moment. Like they ruin the moment to get a photo of it for later by butting in and getting in the road. So you've got to talk to husbands and wife, bride and groom pretty quickly to tell them to control that chap who's running in and spoiling the mystery of it. So you're remembering a moment that didn't happen because people were distracted by a flashing light. Do you know what I'm trying to say? But we can all do that in our life. We look, this is the good as it gets. You won't get a better moment than this right now because we're here. I used to say to the kids when I was a teacher, I don't mind if you go outside, I don't mind what you do, but if you're in the room, we're in here to learn history, French, whatever it was. So let's get into it and enjoy it. What's the good of having your head out there and your body in here? Which is fair enough. She also warns us not to be too greedy. In the complex and arbitrary world in which we live, there's little we can change, and whatever changes we do make can never guarantee success. Look for happiness, yeah, fine, but know that it can't provide what your restless hearts are searching for. Throughout Ecclesiastes, Kohelet is focusing on our profound longing, and now I'll borrow Jesus' words, to live and live to the full. Now, quote from chapter 3, verse 11, God has set the desire for eternity in the human heart. In light of the author's understanding of the finality of death, it's important to remember that by eternity, olam in Hebrew, he means indefinite duration, everlasting. He doesn't mean time beyond death or existence beyond death. He means a long life if it's life, or a long reign if you're the king or whatever, a long marriage if you... We want to be, to know, to love and be loved. We want to be in communion with the source of all life, God. Kohelet wants this for us, but is adamant in warning us not to try to satisfy our desire in all the wrong places in what is hebel, vanity. She calls us to do good as long as we don't expect doing good to lead to good outcomes. Don't do it because it's going to mean success or God will bless you, because plenty of people are good and God doesn't bless them, apparently. So don't do it for any other reason. Do it because it's good. God's ways aren't our ways. We'll never comprehend God or what God is doing in our world. So get on with living and just do it. It's all pretty good, isn't it, don't you think? Like, it's good advice. The text just continues, chapter 3, human beings cannot succeed in discovering that which God accomplishes from the beginning to the end. So when we're doing something, don't say, God told me to do it. But if you want to do that, listen in to the thousands of people who do what God told them to do, and it was absolutely balmy, stupid, and productive of nothing. So you know what I mean, it's a bit silly. Doesn't mean you're not inspired by God. It means don't be too sure about it. Just do your best, but with some humble admission that God is beyond all our questioning. We can surely learn from Coelet's insistence that we live in the present moment. We're not saying, nor is Coelet, that the present moment exists in isolation. Of course it doesn't. The present moment emerges from the past. In turn, it will affect the future. The best preparation for tomorrow is to live today well, not to live in tomorrow and think of all the improvements you can make tomorrow. Live now well and you've got your foundation for the next moment. In both cases, we can't know how the past affects now and how the present affects the future. How much suffering comes from our getting locked into the past, being paralysed by fear of the future. We'd be wise to bear suffering as best we can, but not to let the clouds totally cover the sky. It's where Ignatius Loyola is wonderful. He says, always begin your prayer with gratitude. And if I could just, I remember I had a couple of years of depression a while ago, thank God. But I remember I was given that advice, and I found it to be absolutely true. When everything's black, everything isn't black. And if you look at the day searching hard for something good, I always found there was something. I was amazed. But you see the importance of finding it? Mm-hmm. Otherwise the black just takes over. And on some days, the beautiful thing I remember was a bird would land on the windowsill and go, that's all. I thought, isn't that marvellous? I mean, I didn't invite the bird and it didn't know I was there, but it happened, you know, or it could be this, or, you know. You think of your own life. There are always miracles happening of wonder every day. But if we get depressed, we can not notice them and not have our attention drawn to them. But if we see them, the sky might gradually thin out. So we would be wise to bear suffering as best we can, but not let the clouds totally cover our sky. There are possibilities for joy. Now, accept them with gratitude. Enjoy them to the full. And even if it's you've come home and there's only one thing to greet you and it's a Maltese terrier, thanks be to God. When this little animal jumps into your lap and thinks you're beautiful. Why not? The key is to stop putting ourselves in the centre of the frame. Coelet would have been perfectly at home with another statement of Jesus. Strive first for the kingdom of God and his righteousness. In other words, our attention in the present moment is to be wanting inside, to actually listen and pick up the inspiration. In other words, we've got sail up. There may be no wind, but we're ready for not a hebel, but a movement, and we follow that movement. It's the way God inspires us. Wisdom, another key topic, obviously.
There's
I can't listen now because we're recording. That's the problem. No, after. Is that okay? Because we're recording. The author challenges much of what in his day was considered wisdom, Hokmah. It lacked realism and was too dogmatic. He saw wisdom as a human activity. necessary, therefore, limited. He acknowledges the benefits of genuine wisdom. The heart of a truly wise person helps him or her, and the heart of a fool certainly brings harm. He says that. People are impressed by the words of a wise person. We know that. Wisdom has more power to save a city than does military might. So he says that in chapter 9. So he's not against wisdom in any sense. It has greater effect than the rantings of a ruler among fools, he'll go on to say. Wisdom is a gift from God. It's precious, but at the same time, he's conscious of the essential limitations of human wisdom. He continually warns us against basing our lives on what we inherit from the past without checking it against the facts of our experience. That's pretty good, isn't it? I mean, and maybe there are times where we weren't encouraged to do that, but it has to happen. In today's terms, he insisted that wisdom be evidence-based, not lose its connection with knowledge, dat, what we know. I remember as a young person, it went over my head and that was good. So I was told I was quite scatterbrained as a young boy, and I'm grateful for that, really, because most thoughts I was given got scattered and they didn't lodge. Whereas there are serious-minded people who took it all in and heard it and remembered it. God help us. Anyhow, so that didn't happen to me, apparently. Because, you know, the Trinity, I remember being told about the Trinity, and it was a triangle, and it was three, but there was one, but there was really three, and it's a mystery, and we believe it because we're told it, and I did, and I thought, oh, no, no. What a tragedy it was that somebody didn't then, while I was much younger, talk about the wonder of the Trinity, which is, according to the Catechism, our most fundamental belief. Why didn't they talk about Jesus and his love for the Father? And why didn't they talk about him breathing his spirit into our hearts? You know, why didn't they talk about the indwelling of the mystery of God? In other words, bring it into experience, you know, because all we know about the Trinity is from our experience, which includes, of course, the beautiful experience of Jesus. And it's full of mystery, yeah. But mystery meaning there's too much light, not mystery that it's a conundrum that we can't fathom and so we believe it because it's there. God, I'm getting carried away. Excuse me. Anyhow, here's the Kohelet. The advantage, he says, chapter 7, the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to the one who possesses it. So he's into wisdom, but check it. Wisdom, this is me now, doesn't fit with the actual experience of our life is hebel. Furthermore, we shouldn't expect human wisdom to bring happiness or to satisfy our search for meaning. It won't necessarily do any of that. How much harm is caused by our clinging to traditions that claim wisdom but don't apply to our lives? You must have stacks of memories of that. This is even more true in a rapidly changing modern world. A new situation demands new reflection. Sure, we have a lot to learn from the past, but we must learn to check it against the facts. Is that okay? Do you get what I'm trying to get? That's what he's telling us all the time. Now, we've got to be humble. We've got to realise there's a lot of them. So we've got to know the past, learn about it. For heaven's sake, read the mystics, read the philosophers, do all the stuff that we do, because there's a wealth of human experience all contained there. So get it all as much as we can, but check it all to see does it apply to my life here and now and to your life and to us. Or have some things come in? Have we learnt that the world is not at the centre of the universe now, which they didn't know when they said that? Have we learned about, to go back to the Song of Songs, about sexual relationships and the female part in producing life, which they didn't know when they wrote all about the male dominant stuff before? Are we actually taking all this into consideration when we think theologically? Or are we quoting past wisdoms born out of a limited world, every world's limited, and taking them on board without realising that things have happened to the human mind in the meantime that actually radically change all that? Are we expecting the systems of the church that happened in the first century to still apply today, when you've got education is different to what it was then, the role of woman in society is utterly different, well, not utterly different, it's basically richly the same, but it's women, you know what I mean? In the public world, it's very different from what it was in the first century. So do we quote Paul to give us the answer to our questions, or do we read Paul for the wisdom that he gives us? And we don't know what that wisdom is till we see what questions he was answering and what he was trying to deal with. And when we do all that, we think, because Paul's marvellous, wonderful. And if he lived today, he would write differently, because he was an intelligent, concerned, connecting human being. And he would hate to think that we were quoting a letter he wrote 2,000 years ago to solve a different problem today. But that's what we've got to do. Otherwise, we're disrespecting the wisdom of the past and we're avoiding the freedom to think today. The subject of God. It's significant that God is mentioned 40 times in Ecclesiastes, so it's a very God-centered book. But he never uses the word Yahweh. He only uses the word Elohim, which is the general word God. The author wants his thought to stand independently of specifically Jewish considerations. So he's not writing about our God, he's writing about God, and it applies in Greece, Persia, you get it? That's what he's aiming to do, talk about things without the special theology that fits us men in the Jewish world. He's insistent that we can't know God. So relax. And please remember, he didn't know Jesus. That's what's stunning about Christianity. It's unique about Christianity, that our understanding of God has been shaped, focused by the focal word of the human Jesus. So when Judaism and Islam have got books, yeah, they've got prophets and books and all got their own beauty, our faith is not based on a book. So the Bible is not a book on which we base our faith. Our faith is based on the experience of a person and what he said and did and was and how he was experienced and how that experience has been handed on. So that's stunning, really. And if the whole world, particularly Christians, picked that up, it'd be wonderful, because we'd be freed from this insecurity to try and make a book into God. He's insistent we can't know God. We mustn't use God as a shortcut to truth. But that happens a lot. People will give you a theological answer to your question by avoiding the question and giving an answer. That's not what the answer is. In the words of Solomon, first book of Kings, Yahweh has said that he would dwell in thick darkness. In other words, God is beyond our sight. Basic to everything Kohelet says about God is that everything that happens is done by God. I've done that with you. It's quote chapter 7, verse 14. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other. Do you get it? God created the good thing and God created the bad thing, so that human beings may not find out anything that will come after them. It's all God's business. Just take your moment and make the best of it. I saw, he says in chapter 8, I saw all the work of God, that no one can find out what's happening under the sun. However much they may toil in seeking, they won't find it out, even though those that are wise claim to know, they can't find it. And he's got books of people who claim to know. And he says, they don't know, they're just not asking the right question. He says in chapter 11, just as you do not know how the breath comes to the bones in a mother's womb, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. That's his perspective. This doesn't mean that we should sit on our hands and wait for God to act. As the well-known poem of chapter 3, there's a time for this, you know, that the time for that says so eloquently, there's a time for doing everything. Brackets. By that he means there's no time for doing nothing. There's a time for doing everything, so do it in its time. God does everything according to our author, his understanding, but God chooses to do these things through us. If we do nothing, we can't see what God is doing. We must act so long as we don't expect that what we're doing will have results. Because that's Hebel. It might have it, but it may not. We can't be certain of God's will beforehand. We may be doing something that will have no good results, for God may not be acting through us. It's wisdom to learn from our mistakes, of course. It's wisdom to be open to God's gift. It's wisdom to know that what God does is good and beautiful. It's wisdom to be on the lookout for what is good and beautiful. Above all, we must listen, Shema Israel, listen Israel. That way there is a chance that we may perform what Qohelet calls, quote, chapter 3, the business that God has given to everyone to be busy with. So if we're doing it and we're looking for the effects of it and the quality, maybe we are doing God's will, in which case something wonderful will come. But we don't know that. We just do it according to our best wisdom. We can learn from Qohelet's words not to be too confident in our ability to inquire into the divine. No matter how refined and tested our concepts are, and this applies especially to our concepts of God, they're only our concepts. Theology is a human science. There's no place for pride and arrogance. Let's pursue learning to the best of our ability, but let's hold our conclusions lightly. Always ready to have them corrected or refined. God isn't a cause such that creation is an effect existing outside God. So you imagine there's this room of 50 people here and there's actually God. So that's a 51. There's others as well. So God's there and there's you and you and you and you and you and me. What an idea of God that is. But it's kind of hardwired into us a bit. God is the cause and we're all the effects. Hang on. God is transcendent, yes. In the words of Teilhard de Chardin, God is the heart and beyond of everything. So if we're going to use the word God, we're talking about each other too. We're talking about love. We're talking about the reality of the human condition and our experience of nature and event and person. We're waiting and listening for the heart, the pulse, the inspiration, the spirit at the heart of everything. So we're very open, we're very Catholic in the best sense of that word, open to embrace the whole of the universe and not afraid of any of it, looking for the movement of God. The author of Ecclesiastes may not have used the words fire, but they're consistent with his thinking. For Qohelet, God is first and foremost one who gives, an expression used 15 times. God is the giver. Very good. God is self-giving. God is the gift. And creation, by the way, is the gift of God. You are the gift of God to me, I am to you, and we are to each other. It's all self-giving. In encouraging us to enjoy the simple things of life, Qohelet states, chapter 3, it's God's gift that all should eat and drink and take pleasure in all their toil. Suddenly I notice a lift of feeling in the room. We've had 2 hours of solid talking now. Everyone thinks, eat, drink and be merry. But that's his advice. Grab whatever pleasure you can from the present moment. Wisely. Enjoy it. God for Qohelet is judge in the sense that it is God who dispenses justice. Here's a quote from chapter 11. Follow, beautiful advice this is too, follow the inclinations of your heart and the desire of your eyes. Were you told to do that? Good advice. Follow it. Look at the next bit. But know that all these things God will bring you to judgment. Listen to your heart. Follow your desires. Go for it. But remember, everything you do matters. So don't do it lightly or carelessly or whatever. God, not the instruments of the corrupt system which they're experiencing in Judah. We need God's judgment if we are to find justice. So, Kohelet's, and I won't go into this in great detail now, but I will do it later, his key advice is for us to fear God. That's the bottom line, as it were. Fear God. He says in chapter 8, repeated in chapter 5, though sinners do evil 100 times and prolong their lives, yet I know that it will be well for those who fear God, because they stand in fear before him, but it will not be well with the wicked, neither will they prolong their lives days like a shadow, because they don't stand in fear before God. What's it mean to fear God? I'll do it more fully later, but to fear God is traditional language for approaching God with utter seriousness, which means approaching each other with utter seriousness, which means approaching this beautiful world with utter seriousness. Knowing that God is the transcendent other on whom we completely depend. It is our relationship with the incomprehensible God that alone can give reality and meaning. We're alive because God is breathing his life breath into us. And that's what ultimately matters. The author of Ecclesiastes ends his work encouraging us to, quote, these are the last words of the book, remember the Creator before the dust returns to the earth as it was and the breath returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the teacher, all is vanity. And one last comment. This book is one of the festival scrolls. And this is my commentary on the festival scroll, but one of the 5 festival scrolls of the Jewish community. In other words, those books that they read on key festivals in their liturgical year. Well, this one is read publicly and for the community on the Feast of Sukkot. Excuse me. Why? On the Feast of Sukkot, which means tabernacles or tents or coverings. By living in makeshift shelters, and in the Orthodox Jewish families, they make these little things in the house and you go in like it's a little act, little home play, like we do at Christmas, perhaps. The people relive the experience of their ancestors as they journey through the wilderness, through slavery in Egypt, to the promised land, living in tents, protected only by God. There's no other security. There are no other solid foundations. Only God gives security. That's what they're reliving in that lovely celebration. Elul, whom I quoted earlier, makes the link between Kohelet and the Feast of Sukkot festival. Quote, what book speaks more eloquently of this fragility, challenges everything, requires that we examine our conscience, sweeps away all our rock-solid certainties, leaves us alone with our precarious destiny, stripped bare to experience the only genuine security, the security offered by the sovereign master of history.